Since 2011, American Giant has been making everyday clothing with extraordinary effort. Not in far-off factories, but right here in the USA. We obsess over fabrics, fit, and details, because if you're going to wear it every day, it should feel great and last for years. From the cut of a hoodie to the finishing of a seam, nothing is overlooked. Our supply chain is tight-knit and local, which means less crisscrossing the country and more care in every step. The result is durable clothing, t-shirts, hoodies, sweatpants, and denim that become part of your life season after season. This isn't fast fashion, it's clothing made with purpose by people who care as much about how it's made as how it fits. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Cullen.
Brought to you by PwC.
This is News Talk.
Welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton, and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. However, today, for the day that's in it, we're going to do something a little different. It's all about books today on Taking Stock, and over the next hour, you're going to hear me chat to some of the guests that we've had on Taking Stock here over the year about the best book they have read in 2025. The only direction we gave them was that it had to be a non-fiction book. So you can hear everything from politics to tech and even cricket. Now, of course, you can email us takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on social media at Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now, I'm going to start off today with my own pick for 2025. I had the pleasure of reading The Great Inflation Resurgence, Why Inflation Returned in the 2020s and What to Expect Next, earlier on in the summer, actually. And it gave a real deep dive into inflation all around the world. But it added in the nuance of the once-off temporary things that pushed prices higher, as well as how the world has evolved to locking in a rise in the cost of living. And then I had the real delight to interview one of the authors, namely Thomas Haar, who was the chief economist at the Danish Central Bank. So you can listen back to that interview on podcast, but the full book is well worth a read. Now, first up on our special book show is Russ Mould of AJ Bell, who has spoken to us many times about the state of the markets. He has chosen a fascinating book called Something Changed, Beefy Boadicea, Brixton, Bunting, and How Cricket Helped Change the Nation by Ben Dobson. So first up, Russ, you're very welcome to Taking Stock. And why did you pick this one?
Two reasons. One, I love cricket. I'm actually a qualified England and Wales cricket board coach, level two. So I coach children to play cricket down in my adopted hometown of Brighton. So that's one reason. And secondly, it is a book about economics as much as it is about sport, and it interlinks the careers of Ian Botham, or Baron Botham, as he is now, and Margaret Thatcher, whose first Conservative government had won, got itself into power 2 years before the year covered, and was at the time still in considerable difficulty politically and economically.
Well, I thought it was an interesting connection, as the author certainly drew the comparison between the two of them many times throughout, but it's actually a different connection stood out to me. There was one line, it was in, I think it was the preface or the introduction, that I wanted to get your take on, and it says, the mirrors of 50 years ago are all around us, because Ben, the author, had said this book could be written about 2025. What was your take on that?
That was probably, for me, the bit of the book I found least convincing. I can see where he's coming from. You know, the UK is, you can argue, again, finding life pretty tough economically. It's not exactly covering itself in glory on the cricket field at the moment either, which was certainly the case coming into the time covered by this book. But I'm not completely convinced by that. I think we are in a much better place than we were back in 1981, even allowing for the challenges that we have.
Now, he particularly points out that the year 1981 was the big one. And of course, Margaret Thatcher's reign, if you want to call it that, was much longer than that, certainly stretching more than a decade at the time. But what was it about 1981, from your own memory of the year itself, but also how he describes it in the book? What was it about that year?
Yeah, well, the author Ben Dobson was 14 in that year, and I was 12. So we're not too far apart. I remember several things. One, the weather was absolutely awful in the summer to start with. Two, I remember thinking that England were getting absolutely thumped by Australia, having been horribly outplayed in the first two test matches to go 1-0 down in the series. And three, I remember, although I lived in quite a genteel town of York, I do remember a lot of worries about high unemployment, high inflation, and actual riots on the streets of the UK, whether it was in Brixton or whether it was in Liverpool, and it felt like a pretty challenging and unhappy time in some ways, even for a fairly innocent 12-year-old.
Well, it's interesting there, particularly when you mention about the genteel town of York. It's a city I've been in myself. I think it's absolutely beautiful. But I also think it's important that we look at the way in which the book looks not just at England or Wales, it looks at people right across the country.
Yes.
And I do want to just quote one line to you, because I think this sums up the way in which he uses cricket which he looks at politics, economics, etc. He said, "Many of the writers on this beautiful game, namely cricket, of course, have suggested over the years that cricket, for England and the English in particular, is not simply a game, but an institution which reflects the character of our society and evolves to connect with it over time." What do you think cricket says about the country?
I mean, as a cricket coach, and we have a very simple ethos at our club, which is more cricket for more people more often. We have our own code of conduct, and we do try and encourage the spirit of cricket, not necessarily as, you know, play up and play the game, but we do try and get the sport to be played in the right way. We get the kids to play it for fun, and winning is frankly secondary. If the kids come back safe, come back happy, want to come back next time, then frankly we think we've got it cracked. And I think so. I do still think that cricket is an important part of British society. I fear probably less so, but I still think it's important. But I think certainly in terms of wider sport, the concept that sport feeds into a nation's self-confidence and self-image, whatever the sport happens to be, I think is definitely very true, whether it's rugby union or whether it's cricket or football, whatever it happens to be. I think success on the sporting field can be a huge lift for a nation's morale and confidence. And you can see that in many competitions. And in this case, back in 81, it certainly was very much so for English cricket and for cricket across the UK more widely.
And how do you think, though, that translates to other elements? As you say, a massive sporting achievement can lead to a massive lift in society. But how does that translate then to politics, for example, in the case of Margaret Thatcher, to the economy, which, of course, the book reflects that more broadly? Does one translate between the other clearly?
I mean, I think there was certainly a confluence of events that enables Ben Dobson to put that theory forwards. I mean, the England team, having been horribly outplayed in the first two games, actually won the series 3-1. With decisive contributions from Botham, but also Bob Willis, Graham Dilley, and a few others. But Botham got the Player of the Series award, largely through turning the series round at Headingley in Leeds. And at that point, oddly enough, the weather began to get better, which Dobson remembers, and I didn't. And also, the UK economy began to turn around, and the Thatcher government began to pay off, as in unemployment began to come down, inflation began to come down, but equally, that government's popularity probably really only turned actually the next year in 1982 after the Falklands War concluded. And so that's probably a slightly separate issue. So I think the economy may have been turning around anyway, but then in terms of the popularity of that Thatcher government, which then won a landslide in 83, and that really did unleash some animal spirits and give that government confidence to make the reforms it felt were right, that probably came along. But certainly there was a bit of a turning point in 81 for sure.
I would say many political commentators would point out that just after the Falklands War was indeed the time that the Thatcher government had a change in how legacy was writing it and the way in which that unfolded in history. But there is one other area of the book that I want to ask you. There's a whole chapter on class mobility, and particularly cricket might have a connotation of a certain class in England. And certainly Ben Dobson seeks to overthrow that.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting because, I mean, the England and Welsh Cricket Board wrote a report 2 or 3 years ago saying that the sport is still riven with class division, with misogyny, and that it isn't still offering enough equality and opportunity for all, which, I'd like to think certainly isn't the case at our club. But I think both of them, I think, is interesting in that, you know, he didn't come from a posh background in Cheshire. He was very much a self-made player. And if any, you know, probably wasn't famous for practicing terribly hard, but was brilliantly talented and played beautifully, certainly in the younger stage of his career before injuries took over. So in some respects, there are similarities between him and Margaret Thatcher, not particularly posh backgrounds, driven, self-made, made a big difference, great faith in their own abilities, in fact, almost invincible faith in their own abilities. Equally, there are very big differences. You know, both of them played hard and partied hard, and Margaret Thatcher certainly didn't strike me as being a big party animal, and she wasn't interested in sport in the slightest. So there are big differences between the two, but Baron Botham, as he is now, although he sits as a crossbench peer in the House of Lords, he was certainly known to be conservative politically, whether with a small C or a big C, even if he wouldn't necessarily viewed himself as being Thatcherite. And certainly there were, you can argue there were some parallels between them politically, but in terms of and how they carried about their business, now they were successful, but equally, you know, they're very different personalities in other ways.
That was Something Changed, Beefy, Bodacia, Brixton, Bunting, and How Cricket Helped Change the Nation by Ben Dobson. And that is Russ Mole's book pick for 2025. This is Susan Hayes Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk, and you're listening to a special show where we're talking to some of our regular contributors about their favourite books. Loads more to come. Welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton, and we're chatting to some friends of the show about their favourite books. And next up is Kate English, Chief Economist with Deloitte. So, Kate, your pick is How Big Things Get Done by Bent Fliveberg and Dan Gardner. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so I'm going to be honest. I judged this book by the cover. I picked it up because of its title. We've had so many conversations this year in Ireland about infrastructure projects, and that's what intrigued me to it. The book, as you said, by Bent Fliveberg and Dan Gardner, they are looking at a total database of 16,000 large projects that have been completed all across the world, including everything from the Sydney Opera House to roads, rail, to even some home renovations. So it is an extensive database.
Spot the economist, the woman who loves the data.
How could I not go for it? But, you know, they talk about, well, what are the things you need in place in order for big projects to get complete? And some of the statistics at the start of it are really startling. So out of those 16,000 projects, just 8.5% of projects were finished on time and on budget. And in addition to that, just 0.75% of projects were on time, on budget, and delivered the benefits they promised to deliver.
Well, let's talk about one of the ones that didn't happen, because the book starts off with a compelling case of the high-speed train linking San Fran and Los Angeles in 2.5 hours, costing $86 a ticket. So I was reading this anyway, Kate, thinking, like, I have gone between those two cities, sat in traffic as I was driving between them. Wouldn't it have been great to get this? However, of course, it didn't materialise because, as the authors highlight, the project started off with a burst of energy and then got lost in politics, cost overruns and frustration. Did that remind you of anything that you've seen here in Ireland?
I think it reminds me of quite a few, not only here in Ireland, but also in other countries around the world as well. And we know it is incredibly difficult to deliver large scale infrastructure. Your mind is probably going straight away to the metro
it
project.
Is. And the Children's Hospital and several more, yeah.
As my mind did as well. But I think from this, yes, there was a lot of focus on what can't be delivered, but there was, how do you try and rectify that? And this is the intrigue for me of the book. And you know, there's two things, and it's almost like, what can Lego and cartoons tell you about delivering large scale projects? If we start with the Lego piece, and this was a key part of towards the end of the book, I'm not giving away spoilers here because it's mentioned at the outset, that if you think of any large scale project as delivering Lego, and it is all built in the term of modular construction. And actually, it's trying to get people to think about not having a construction site actually be an assembly site. And whether it's you're building a road, you're building a rail network, that these are all only components like Lego that you are joining together after being manufactured somewhere else. The second piece, if I pull you to the cartoon, and this was fascinating. So where cartoons come in is Pixar, and how Pixar films are made. So it spoke through that a lot of the danger with building or completing large-scale projects, the cost overruns, the time delays, they come into play when you're at the delivery stage. That is the most riskiest time of all for projects to go wrong. How do you mitigate that? You mitigate against it in your planning stage. So Pixar, when they're making their films, they spend a lot of time doing all the hand drawings, countless number of hand drawings for every scene, all the characters. They film those hand drawings for 90 minutes, put sound over it, and do anywhere from 7 to 9 iterations of those hand drawings ever before they get to studio, where you have the expensive actors coming in for the voiceovers and you're using the expensive technology to create the animations. So by the stage, they're incorporating the costly pieces. They have all their problems already ironed out.
One of the things that struck me about the book was who had written a piece of praise for it. And of course, it was the author of the book, Thinking Fast and Slow.
Yes.
There was real rhymes there, I thought, Kate, particularly with the whole idea of thinking slowly about your planning and then implementation. But can I ask you, after you read this, how did you translate the book's learnings into your own behaviour?
Yeah, that phrase actually of think slow and act fast was probably the key takeaway I had from it all. And it's that piece of plan, do your iterations. And then once you're at the delivery stage, you have little room to go wrong. Or if things do go wrong, you already have your mitigations in place. So for me, I'll be honest, in work, I am incredibly organized. In my personal life, I am not. I am last minute Sally. Everything is done at the last minute for when things can actually go wrong. So really for me, it's that think slow, do many iterations of your planning, be that in the work stage or personal life, so that once you get to delivery and actually seeing a project through, you've already done a lot of your mitigation or put solutions in place for that. And I think that's really powerful.
Now, Kate, you're going to Australia in a couple of hours at this point. Tell us, have you planned out everything that you're going to be putting in the suitcase, or is last minute Sally going to be rearing her head again?
I am proud to say, for the first time in my life, and maybe it's because I read this book, the bag is packed, it's zipped up, it's closed, it is ready to go. And that's very unlike me. So this book has influenced me.
So you are actually practicing what you preach?
I'm practicing what I preach, believe it or not.
That is fantastic. I have to say, my last question is, what do you think is highlighted in the book that is consistently done wrong in the country? Particularly I'm thinking of the Accelerating Infrastructure Report and various other projects throughout that we've read and heard about many times throughout the year. What in the book do you think, whether it's the government or planners, need to read because we're missing the point?
You know what, for me, there's a concept about thinking right to left. I'm not sure if you've heard about this, but what it is that you're essentially planning from the get-go your end goals. What do you want the clear benefit to be from this? Not the planning of the actual project to begin with. It is, what is your end goal? What is the solution, the problem you're trying to solve, and working all the way back from that. And sometimes I feel, even though we do have very good, well laid out plans, do we have a clear overall vision for what we want Ireland to be or what we want our cities to be? And is that thinking right to left concept that we are missing?
Another book, of course, that I'm sure people are thinking of as they're listening to is The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People by Stephen Covey. You know, start with the end in mind. Kate, we could keep going here forever. However, you have a flight to catch. And since the bag is ready to go, thank you very much for coming into studio for today. But also as well, thank you for all of your contributions this year. You've been a super friend of Taking Stock, and thank you. That was Kate English, Chief Economist at Deloitte, and her 2025 book pick is How Big Things Get Done by Bent Fliveberg and Dan Gardner. Now, next in our hit list of people recommending their favourite books is Ben Spencer, the science editor with the Sunday Times. Now, Ben, you picked Our Brains, Ourselves by Masoud Hossein. It's an intriguing read, but will you first of all tell us why you picked it?
Yeah, it's a really good book, and I read a lot of science books and medical books, and this really stood out this year. It's the humanity of it, really. So this neurologist, Masoud Hossein, who's at Oxford, he told the stories of seven of his patients, all affected by neurological conditions. And that, you might think that was quite grim subject for light reading, but it was just absolutely fascinating. So he goes through these stories, one chapter for each patient, and he's got this woman called Trish who told him she had a new lover, but she did not want her husband Steve to find out. And then she tells the doctor, strangely enough, he's also called Steve, and it turns out she thought she was having an affair with her own husband. She thought there were two blokes and there was actually one. And it was the early signs of dementia. And he kind of unpicks the way neurological conditions can make these quite profound changes in people's personalities. He talks about a man who ran out of words. His vocabulary just was disappearing. This is a very erudite man, very accomplished, but he couldn't remember the word for a rake. He just couldn't describe what he was looking at. There was a very accomplished young man who was a young professional and just one day stopped going to work. He just couldn't be bothered anymore. He couldn't be bothered to have a shower or to get out of bed. And this was, it turns out, the result of a stroke.
Was that David?
Yeah,
that was the character, yeah. David. I wanted to pick up on that one in particular because just to elaborate on that particular story, in the case of David, he had had two strokes, both different as a result of two different reasons. And just as you said, he just stopped having interest in anything. But as I was reading through that chapter, Ben, I was expecting a happy ending because, of course, you're dealing with a neurologist, namely the author, and there wasn't one. And I thought that was particularly striking about this book is that there were stories of patients who needed to live with the consequences of what they had as distinct to could simply be solved.
Yeah, that's right. And there aren't always cures and happy endings. And that's sadly the nature of medicine. But it's in quite a few of them there were. And as time goes on, you know, these we learn more about the brain and we learn more about neurology thanks to the work of people like Professor Hussein. And, you know, you get more and more of these. But it's the understanding of the brain, which I think, you know, they say it's one of the things that we know least about. It's so complex. You know, we're years behind where we are with cancer for things like dementia and Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and epilepsy.
Another thing, though, that struck me about the book was the style of it. I felt that I was having the chats with Dr. Yeah. Hussein. I felt that there was sometimes I heard about how he felt being an outsider. And we will talk about the role of that had, because that was a significant part of the book, too. But or his observations as he was dealing with patients like David, the style of it was quite discursive.
I think he's an excellent writer, I have to say. I mean, I started off with, so this was for the Sunday Times Science Books of the Year, and I chose, I don't know, 7 or 8 books. But I started with about 60. And, you know, this was a very, very well-written book. And it's with these science books, you don't just want something that's going to teach you something. You want something that's going to rattle along. And you want to read, you're going to keep reading. Because otherwise you just find yourself skipping pages and skipping chapters. And I didn't do any of that with this one.
It was accessible. I do agree with you there when you say about rattling along. I'm sure it was technical to somebody who's more educated in that area than I am. But it was the nature of the narrative and the story and the humanity, as you say.
Yeah, and that was it really. It's the human stories. And this overriding theme which he weaves into it, which is about identity and belonging and how that can change very quickly on, because, you know, what's normal, you know, this idea of what's normal can mean someone's can become very alienated very quickly from their community if they don't behave in a certain way.
Well, that I thought was the central tenet of the book. And there's just a quote here I want to read out to listeners. He says, people who develop a brain disorder can experience a profound change, not only in their personal identity, but in their social identity. And I found that a really profound point, that we think we're a product of our experiences and upbringing and social circle and possibly our employer and culture. But he makes the point that a change to our brain chemistry can change that in an instant.
That's right. And he was particularly good, I thought, on immigrant communities coming from... Mm-hmm. He was born in East Pakistan, what is called Bangladesh now. And he talks quite movingly about how that affected his early life coming to London and Birmingham, growing up in those places as someone not from there originally. And he tells the story about this bus driver... I think he was Pakistani. And he started having hallucinations, and he thought he was going mad. And turns out to be, you know, it was a neurological condition. But he was essentially shunned by his community, and they stopped inviting him to community events. And where you've got very tightly knit communities, particularly where you have diasporas in big cities from places like Pakistan, or there was example of someone from the Caribbean, and if you get shunned from that community due to certain religious or social understandings or beliefs, then that can be very damaging. And just that instant twist of a behavior, so you're not quite one of us anymore. I thought that was really interesting.
And I thought the story he told about when he was speaking at his first conference in the UK, when nobody was paying any attention to him when he stood up, first of all. But then he was just saying about it was incongruent, that was the word he used, the sound of his accent and how he looked as a person, that there was a juxtaposition there that got everybody listening. And I just thought it was interesting how, from his own perspective, picking up on his own immigrant status, but where he wanted to be and that sense of being an outsider, working his way in to be inside. It really is, it's a great read, and I'm delighted that you recommended it as your 2025 pick. Thank you very much, Ben, not just for joining us today, but indeed right throughout the year. Ben Spencer, science editor of the Sunday Times, and his pick of 2025 is Our Brains, Ourselves by Massad Hossein. This is Susan Hayes Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk, and we're looking at the top book choices of some of the regular voices here on Taking Stock. After the break, we hear from economist Dan O'Brien. Now you're welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton, and now we are going to go to Dan O'Brien to ask him about his best read of the year. Dan, you picked Dictating the Agenda, The Authoritarian Resurgence in World Politics by Alexander Cooley and Alexander Dukalkasis. Can you tell me about the book, please?
I can indeed, Susan, and thanks for having me on. So I don't know about you, but I find I'm reading less economics these years than I used to. Mainly because the glorious 30 years of peace and prosperity that we enjoyed, at least here in Europe, after 1989 has really come to an end. And Europe's no longer at peace. We've got a major war in Eastern Europe and a real risk that it could spread. We've got a hybrid war going on in Europe, and we were touched by that recently ourselves. And there was a question about whether President Zelensky's plane was, there was an effort to take that down. So this book, written by two American academics, the latter of which happens to be based here in UCD, sets out loads of evidence in a really kind of rigorous way, looking at different measures of dictatorships and authoritarian governments around the world. It examines the shift in power away from the democratic world over the last 20 years. The kind of standout, of course, is China is now a superpower, a completely undemocratic country, and one that has not evolved into a sort of cooperative partner with the democratic world, but behaves more like the Soviet Union with money. It also discusses countries like the Gulf states who use their influence and their money around the world and in democratic countries. And of course, then there's Russia as well, which is the great disruptor and is much more aggressive. The book was written just as Donald Trump was returned to power. So in that sort of context of a shift towards authoritarianism, there are clearly authoritarian instincts in Trump and his administration. So I think it's pretty depressing, but I think it gives a very good broad analysis of the direction the world is taking politically.
Well, to pick up on the very first thing you said about reading less economics, what I do find that I am doing more of is certainly reading more about geopolitics, anthropology, technology, and actually, Dan, the stretch in the Overton window. So this book was actually right up my street. I thought it was an intriguing confluence of all of the above. I will say I didn't think it was easy bedtime reading now. This page by page, paragraph by paragraph needed a lot of focus, and I really liked that about it. Just, you also mentioned about the point of one of the authors being based in UCD. There was a really global reflection on this, and not just the Western world, which I liked as well. What was your take on the fact that it tried to do so many things at once?
Well, it certainly is. You're right. It does pack a lot in. But, and it's not It's not light reading, but it's not written in a sort of stodgy academic way. It is pretty readable. But yeah, it's definitely, you know, a heavyweight book written, you know, as an academic. It's an academic. It's a book written by academics, not only for academics. As I say, it is accessible enough to the general reader. But you're right, it covers an awful lot of ground. It is, as I say, a little bit on the depressing side, given all that's happened in the world. But you know, there are a couple of things I think business people in the business world would be interested in. There are very good chapters on sport and the business of sport globally, and how authoritarian governments are using sport and teams and franchises to increase their influence. And then there's a very good chapter as well on the media business globally, and how authoritarian governments are funding their mouthpieces and having them become more influential globally. We think of RT, Russia, what used to be called Russia Today, and how authoritarian governments, again, China is a particular case, where they're shutting down foreign journalists from reporting in the country. They're not giving them visas to report from the countries. So they're reducing the amount of coverage Western free media is able to focus on dictatorships.
Well, you mentioned that it's slightly depressing, but I think one has to engage with that fundamentally, if that's the way it is, as distinct to if we all just look for the bright things in life, we won't be able to deal with the respective realism that it needs. But your point there, particularly about the media, I just found it interesting that the research in the book pointed out that freedom of expression is the underlying component of democracy that recorded most change or decline in the 10 years to 2022. How it drew the connections between a decrease in democracy can lead to a decrease in the freedom of speech. And therefore, one of the lenses of those would be through media. But it was more expansive than that, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, it goes through, you know, a whole many aspects of the media business, from the gruesome story of Saudi Arabia killing a Saudi journalist based who was in a Saudi diplomatic mission, Turkey. It looks at the way authoritarian governments are sourcing news for their own countries from the mouthpieces of other authoritarian governments, thereby kind of reinforcing, instead of sort of a dictatorship where people could have access, say, to the BBC, governments are trying to channel news from other authoritarian governments to their citizens. So we live, unfortunately, there are a lot of negative trends in the world right now. And as you say, you know, we can't stick our head in the sand. Of course, we need to, as you say, you know, look at the positive things like technological developments. But the geopolitics and the politics of the world, unfortunately, if you believe in democracy and freedom, is not going in the right direction. And I think this book very well captures the whole range of ways that the democratic world is losing out to the authoritarian world.
Well, there was one way, Dan, that became very clear, and this is another quote from it. Liberal democracies have lost their once dominant share of global economic power. That was in around about the first third of the book, and it was made from a point of view, particularly of GDP and how that had changed. The other thing, though, and you've alluded to it there, is just how domestic matters can use international realms in order to communicate their own goals and objectives in a simpler way than ever before, because of interlocked supply chains or because of cybersecurity or the lack of it. There's so much about this book that I found absolutely fantastic. I highly recommend it, and I know you do too, obviously. That's the reason you picked it. So thanks very much indeed, Dan O'Brien, who's joined us today, and his 2025 book pick is Dictating the Agenda: The Authoritarian Resurgence in World Politics. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you, Susan.
Now, finally today, I would like to talk to Elaine Burke, who is the host of For Tech's Sake podcast, about her favourite read of the year. Elaine, you've picked Unlocked by Pete Etchells. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so I actually came across this through someone else recommending it. Nicola Fox-Hamilton, who's a great cyber psychologist based here in Ireland, was talking about how great this book was near the start of the year. And obviously that prompted me to pick it up myself. And I really have thought about it so much since I read it near the start of the year, because it's been so applicable to things that have come up and started trending this year. And we're trending before then as well, because it's about our screen time. And it actually goes into what the research is really telling us about screen time, our relationships with technology, our relationships with devices, impact on mental health and things like that. And there's some maybe more popular books in this area. So the Jonathan Haidt book, The Anxious Generation, is a really prominent title in this area in terms of children's use of technology. And then there's the Johan Hari book, Stolen Focus, which is quoted a lot by people blaming technology on stealing our attention and things like that. And this actually gives a bit of a counter narrative to a lot of that stuff, and it gives a real evidence-based narrative for it as well, kind of telling us that, I mean, when it comes to the idea that our attention is being stolen by these things, it does argue that that's kind of like a techno-deterministic viewpoint and makes it seem like we're powerless against what technology design can make us do, when really, if you think about these things less about clinical terms like addiction, it also kind of like argues why that's not really an appropriate term when we talk about these technologies. If we think about it more as like habit forming, you can actually, if you see it like that, you can actually take more control and think about it differently in how you try to change your behaviour as well.
Well, what I found about the narrative, particularly towards the beginning of the book, is that Pete Eccles does not like the simplistic view, screen time and the more of it equals simply bad things, that there's more nuance to it than that. It's about what we're watching, it's about how we're watching it, it's about, as you say, the habits that we're forming around it, and the social cohesion that can arise from screen time as well. I thought the very beginning tenet of the whole thing is we can't just equate with more screen time equals more bad outcomes.
Yeah, and I think the crux of that is something that I've been trying to bring more to my reporting as well, is that we kind of have to stop thinking of these things as like a single boxed entity, and like that online is one thing and then real life is another thing, because that's really not reflective of reality these days. Like, even when he's talking about things like young people's interactions with technologies, there was a point in it where I was quite struck by the realization that it's really hard for us as adults to understand where they're coming from when they're life has always included some kind of social interaction that is mediated by technology or a social platform or something like that. They've never lived in the digital natives generation. They've never lived through a time where that wasn't part of it. So I think it can be hard for us sometimes to get perspective on that.
Well, I have a different perspective, I suppose, because I spend a lot of time working, particularly with transition years, like an enormous amount of time with them. And they tell me, Elaine, that everything is there. Like, their homework is sent to them on Teams. Their friends are all on Snapchat. TikTok has replaced the TV, like, so one screen with another, one could argue. It's how they find out information. It's how they order takeaway. It's how they use Google Maps to get from A to B. We, as in you and I and the older generations than teenagers, have created a world where their screen time is almost involuntary.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, and we don't sometimes acknowledge that when we think about sweeping legislation, like let's ban children from phones and things like that, which is, you know, like I said, about like reflecting reality. And also, like, he tries to be reflective of reality when he talks about things like the concept of a digital detox, say, which is something that people might start to practice in January. It seems to be quite popular then. But he does compare it to even like fad dieting. You know, those things don't work. They tend to be restrictive, and they actually are restricting you of something, say, in the terms of the diet world, it'd be restricting you from food that you enjoy and things that you like. And it's the same if you think about trying to be very restrictive about your technology engagements. You would be cutting yourself off from the good things. There are lots of good things, material goods that come from this. I'm not denying, and I'm on record giving out about a lot of the negatives as well, but we probably focus a lot in our media and reporting on the negatives, and we don't report what's going right and what's functional and what's working.
Just on that, I thought it was interesting that he said peak screen time certainly isn't none. Like, he said that if one has an absence of screen time, that can lead to an unhelpful outcome, particularly, again, if you're not communicating with people that you love or your friends, etc. And I thought that was quite a refreshing perspective, is that it's not binary.
Exactly. And it's different for different people. And he really dives into like this broad look at what the research is telling us when we have research. And he finds that a lot of the research when it comes to, say, talking about screen time and its impacts relies heavily on self-reporting. So the subjects taking part in the research will self-report about their screen time and their feelings around it. And he finds that what the research is probably most definitively telling us is that people who are most concerned about their screen time have a perception of it being more negative. And that kind of makes sense from a psychological perspective, that it is something that you're worried about, that you're ruminating upon, that you will perceive it that way. And that's probably one of the clearest connections that we can make, rather than saying directly more screen time means less mental health outcomes, because broadly speaking, the research is not pointing in that direction, because there's lots of examples where it's been positive for people.
And so, Elaine, you mentioned that as a result of reading this book, you've been thinking about it a lot and you wanted to reflect it in your reporting. But how has it changed your own screen time behaviour, or has it?
I've already ascribed to a lot of things that Pete Etchells preaches in the book, in terms of limiting our notifications, limiting the things that are, you know, effectively a distraction to us and pulling our attention. And it kind of solidified a track that I was already on, in terms of trying to make sure that my engagements with technology and these tools and platforms are intentional. And that can be tricky, because we are often dealing with platforms that, while they pitch themselves as doing something like connecting us or helping us share things or helping us be informed, they also, in their design, do try to distract us from that purpose and do things that are, you know, to the business end of that platform: buy things, engage in e-commerce, engage with advertising and things like that. So I try to be way more conscious that when I'm engaging with technology, that there is an intent behind it. Now, sometimes that intent might be to chill out and relax and actually switch off my brain and watch cat videos for a while. Sometimes that is my plan. But also, I don't want that to happen when my plan is to actually open up an app to get something done, that I'm getting distracted by other things.
I must also ask, Elaine, one of the defining characteristics of 2025 in this world, I think, has been the production of adolescence. Mm. And what you're describing there with that intentionality is what one will say who might be working or who's got a business, or someone who produced a podcast like you. I can completely see where you come from on that. But I'm sure there's listeners today worried that their teenagers are either addicted to their phones or watching the wrong stuff, and that could take a sinister approach. How do you balance the books here, and what can we take from the book in order to help people who would have that valid concern?
Yeah, and they are absolutely valid concerns. And I definitely wouldn't agree with, say, very young children, and also children who have a certain level of maturity, being allowed completely free rein access to the internet. I don't think there's any good argument to say that that is a good idea. And I've also heard from our psychotherapist for children and adolescents, Colman Nochter, on this, on my own podcast, and his take was to kind of not actually put a year on it. It's not like children wake up at 16 and they're suddenly more mature. Like, you do have to kind of observe your child and their level of maturity on this before you start letting them freely navigate these things without any supervision. And again, it's kind of like that concept that I took away from Unlocked in a big way, which was to really start properly considering that these things aren't a separate world. They are knitted into the real world. They are part of our everyday reality. And if that's the case, you have to start seeing it like that, that if you are allowing your child late at night to be roaming the internet freely, like, that is kind of the equivalent of letting them wander down O'Connell Street in the middle of the night, in terms of like the vast array of things that they could encounter on that journey. And if you think of it like that, you would never allow that to happen. So if you try to actually frame these things as physical concepts, it will make your decision making a bit easier, I'd imagine.
Elaine Burke, as ever, wise words and deeply thought through insights as well. Thank you very much indeed for joining us, not just today, but right throughout 2025. That was Elaine Burke, who picked Unlocked by Pete Etchells as her read of the year. Thanks so much, Elaine.
Thanks a million for having me.
Well, that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes-Cullerton. I hope you enjoyed the special book show, and I'm so grateful for every single one of you who've listened this year, sent in a message during the year, or said something to me about the show if I've met you when I've been out and about. I also, of course, want to thank the incredible team here at News Talk, who has given me the honour to work with them on Taking Stock. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast first, on Friday mornings on the News Talk app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. Now, on research this week with Stephen Daunt, Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Now, the producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy, and he suggested this week that I would play out with my favourite Christmas song. Now, one instantly jumped to mind, all right, but it's actually heavily influenced by one of our most loyal listeners. Michael Hayes, originally from Killavarrig in Timoleague and now in Dripsea in Cork, also my dad, loves Fairy Tale of New York. And you might say, well, what about my mam? And my mam said to me earlier on this year, well, don't be talking about me now on the radio, so I better not mention her. Haha. So, Dad, this one is for you.
It was Christmas Eve, babe, in the drunk tank, an old man said to me, won't see another one, and then he sang a song, the rare old mountain tune. I turned my face away and dreamed about you. Got on a lucky one.
With the state of today's economy, it's more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made from the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back in your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality, made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.